Hello,
Mark.
Okay, so Frank Niepold. Lisa?
Hello, this is Lisa from Brookfield Zoo.
Great. Yeah, and this is Mark McCaffrey from the National Center for Science Education. And we have a very small group today, Frank Niepold and you and me.
Oh, and Roberta Burns from Lexington, Kentucky.
Okay, great. Anybody else?
I thought there would be more people on the call.
Sounds like just the four of us today.
I just joined. This is Caroline Lewis.
Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
So, as I think a lot of you know, next week we'll be having a two-hour discussion about the Next Generation Science Standards. And I think the first hour will be kind of focusing on some of the background, and then the second hour will primarily focus on discussing some of the pros and cons of the standards. Has everybody had a chance to take a look at them yet?
I've just glanced at them. This is Roberta here. And as everybody has acknowledged, they are quite complex, so I wish I could do the webinar that's coming up that I guess they're offering. I'm not really sure how to narrow my focus to get the most out of my review.
Mm-hmm. And Kentucky is one of the states that's part of the process, right?
Yes.
Have you had any discussions with the people within the state at the State Board of Education?
Not yet. I do know our Kentucky representative. I don't know him very well, but I kind of have been waiting for at least our local science listserv to start generating conversation. There's been a lot of emails back and forth just stating that they're out, but not a lot of discussion yet, other than people complaining that they weren't grade specific in middle school, and I think the Kentucky representative has been answering those kinds of questions about why they're not that specific yet.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, there's been no discussion about certain aspects of the standards or anything like that. So.
Right. So there is a webinar tonight that the NSTA is organizing. I just got off the phone with Ted Willard, who's one of our colleagues formerly at Project 2061 at AAAS and now at NSTA. So I think tonight at 6 o'clock Eastern time, there will be the first NSTA discussion that kind of provides background on the standards. And then there's another one, I can't remember exactly when it is, but it's coming up soon. And there was a email on the Climate Literacy Network list about that, the second one, which is more about how to organize a little study group. But so anyhow, why don't we just kind of go around? We've got a small group today, and I actually have to take off about 1:45 the hour to head over to the dentist here, but... maybe we can just kind of update each other on anything new. Frank, what's happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, unfortunately, these days there's a lot of focus on the FY13 budgets, so it's a little unclear as to exactly how the landscape is going to shape out for ongoing funding for climate change education across NSF, NASA, and NOAA. It's a serious concern of the community. I would say that the impacts of that funding issue would be delayed by a couple of years before we're really starting to see no new grants coming online. But it's not to be surprised that this is going on. But I think it's important to note that these. We'll see how things move forward. Obviously, NSF is the major funder this year, and it's unclear what's happening with the NASA NICE initiative. But that's definitely something to worry about for And then the one other thing is, you know, I think it's important that our community take a look at the next generation science standards with one particular frame in mind, which is the integration of the design science solutions aspects of the standard.
Yeah.
Because it's a little buried in the way they're currently structured, and so the implications it has for teaching are considerable, and this window doesn't open up very often.
So, window in terms of standards.
Yeah, exactly. The last time this window was open was 96.
Yeah.
So that was a little while ago. So, you know, the ramifications for that are out there for some time. But, you know, I think there are definitely some windows in there, but it's something that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I would say is I was at a summit related to the standards, and there's a lot of conversation about assessments, professional development, and curriculum, all related to what's going on here and the scientific practices and engineering practices intersecting with the science core disciplines. It offers a really interesting interplay, but the implications on the at least the states that sign up for this are pretty sizable. So I think the one thing that, you know, even though we're a small group today, the implications of how we think about this relative to our work is really quite considerable.
Yeah.
I'm not sure everybody gets what a lot of thinkers in this field are, but there's some really fundamental shifts going on that are, I think, in the end, healthy. So.
Yeah, but there's going to be some folks who, in fact, we've heard through the grapevine that some people involved for decades in science education who are steeped in the traditional disciplines of physics and chemistry are kind of upset because they're not finding the usual content displayed in these new standards in the way that they're used to. So,
well, you know, there's an interesting conversation to have here, which is standards in many ways are minimums. Now, I don't know if everyone would agree with that, but the kids who go into AP chemistry are the standards, you know, a barrier for that, or are they just saying that you can do everything in the standards and then go above and beyond?
Yeah. Well, theoretically, these standards are for all students. And
right, but what I mean is that it doesn't narrow this. It's an important subtle point, though, but it doesn't necessarily narrow what could happen for students. It just means that, you know, in the normal set of time that most all students take, they would cover all this content. If
yep.
you want to go further, there's nothing barring you from that except for the fact that you can't not cover something else that's in the standards in the process. They're
yep.
supposed to be a set. Anyway, it's an interesting point. Yeah, I'm happy about that concern.
Somebody have a comment there?
No, I'm good.
Lisa, were you commenting or?
No.
I do. This is Caroline. I do think educational standards have got to be attainable if they are for everybody, and
yeah.
so the sense that they're very watered down is a real concern for scientists.
Yeah.
But I think emphasizing that they are minimum and an AP chemistry kid is going to be way above and beyond that
yeah.
helps. I mean, as an educator, these teachers are killing themselves to try and meet standards with some of these very unable kids. And to raise those basic standards any higher, knowing that these schools are getting labeled and graded based on performance, it's a double-edged sword. I want the standards higher, but I also think with the American goal of educating everybody and measuring everybody,
yeah.
the reality factor, the realistic factor, calls for a more seemingly watered-down set of science standards.
Yeah, I mean, I think from what I've looked through, that some of these are actually maybe too advanced. I'm looking at middle school Earth and Space Science on Human Impacts, And one of the kind of, in a way, it's an assessment. Students who demonstrate understanding can, and one of those bullets is design engineering solutions for stabilizing changes to communities by, for instance, using water efficiently, reducing the release of greenhouse gases, minimizing human impacts on environments and local landscapes. But that's at a middle school level, to design engineering solutions for those types of challenges. And
they even know what engineering solutions are.
Yeah, I know. I think the idea is that it's kind of using a problems-based approach, which, as we all know, can be a very, very effective way of engaging people and bringing kind of a context to the learning.
But, you know, Mark, one of the things that's always been a challenge in this whole educational reform field is time. And, can middle school students on the whole, and I don't know what the whole means, I don't know if it's 100% work in that, I think the answer is probably yes. The devil's in the details. But the real question is, if you're trying to do it in 50 minutes total, yeah, that's not going to work. But yeah, I think the real challenge is always the case is the mile wide inch deep problem.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a whole push to what's the balance between these things and how much time and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that's more where the issue is, in my opinion, than it is the fundamental abilities of middle schoolers to do these things. You can do them. Just a matter of will the time be there to do them?
Yeah.
That's been my experience.
And it becomes a checklist for the teachers. I mean, they pay lip service to a discussion for 20 minutes, and they've checked it off the list. So the depth at which some of these are really addressed and how we test or evaluate a teacher teaching it and a student learning it, it's a long way to go in all of that, I think.
Yeah.
Caroline, the implications for professional development here are tremendous.
And I tell you, the more I talk on this conference call with you all, and the more I do my work, I think as much as I don't want to, I need to spend a lot more time peppering that mile-wide, inch-deep thing that everybody is feeding from with a lot more provocation for deeper learning, because that's the trough where everybody is, and we're trying to get deep science into some of these silos and science teaching that we have to keep doing, but God, we're missing a whole segment of society. And, you know, somebody, I think it was Frank, who sent a longitudinal study that was sent out at Aztec on the Smorgasbord of Informal Learning. Do you remember that paper? Did anybody read it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and that is just pounding a nail in the coffin of my need to foster that smorgasbord with access to people like you all and the work that you're doing. And I'm enjoying the conversations happening on the network lately on do we really need to be playing this game with tweets and Twitter and, you know, what's the real point of this versus that, and is systems thinking something that's impossible to think? And I actually think that it's a shame the funding is going away, because I think some serious funding needs to go into educating the big picture of systems thinking. And by that I mean, remember that rainbow poster that somebody shared about that thing put me over the edge, because I just loved the way the information was organized for a lay person. Now, it was way too wordy and packed with information, but I'm thinking there are tools out there, or people need to create more tools that feed the systems thinking, the analysis of biodiversity itself as a trigger of ecosystem change, and that the soundbite thinking and the trough, the mile-wide, inch-deep thing needs attention.
Yeah. I've recently become tuned into some of the work that the Hewlett Foundation has been doing. They're based here in the Bay Area, and they have actually invested something on the order of $140 million over the past 10 years into online education resources. And a couple different projects. One of them is called CK12.org, and they've got online flexbooks that are interesting. I don't know quite how they are reviewed, you know, in terms of making sure that they're current and accurate, and, you know, like the CLEAN project has done, to make sure the science is robust and the pedagogy is strong. But
what's it called?
CK12.org. So that's one of the projects funded by the Hewlett Foundation. And I was just looking the other day at the strategic plan for the Hewlett Education Group, and one of the priorities they have is deeper learning, and, you know, in addition to open education resources, they're looking at how can we really encourage deep learning as opposed to
right. What's the real hook to that? And you know, this whole designing these programs and initiatives with layers of access and layers of achievement is one way to get that group that I think is not even at the trough. And I kind of like talking about that, but I also think that if we didn't have the folks right on the call right now working on zeroing in on these set standards to make sure that some of our basic climate literacy stuff is not articulated. In other words, we got to play in both rings.
Yeah.
You know, Caroline, you raise a really important point, and I think that you know, early in the funding from the grant programs, we had high hopes that, you know, sizable amounts of money were going to come. And even with phase two CSEP, you know, grants at, you know, $10 million over 5 years, you know, we quickly came to realize that that's not a lot of money.
Well, actually, the solicitation says it's $38 million over 5 years.
Yeah, but that's across multiple. It was supposed to be 50. And so what I'm saying, Mark, it's spread over a group of projects.
Yeah.
Down at the project level, I mean, you just mentioned $140 million, yeah. And, you know, that was a hell of a lot of money. But even so, if you said, you know, what amount of money done by which group of people doing what things would actually
right.
make a difference,
right.
I think we all would know that the number would be higher. You know, I think a lot of the ideas are in the community. A lot of the teams exist, a lot of the next steps, but it's come down to pretty much a funding issue. I don't see the federal government playing a large role in that funding, but, you know, there's another issue that I think our community needs to struggle with is, you know, a lot of the science agencies are getting disengaged by either OMB or Congress from this enterprise. So that they're saying that you just do science, education will take care of it, and the Department of Education will take care of
right.
that. And, you know, so, I mean, that's my lifeline into this community. And
so they're trying to put these departments in silos rather
right.
than have the weaving of resources and talent and ideas,
well,
which
but,
is what we're
more
yeah.
specifically, Caroline, is to say the science agencies are just supposed to do science and the education people do education, and somehow the science and education will be sound scientifically without, you know, I mean, we all know that that's a joke.
But so that's almost contradicting the broader impacts component they pushed for a long time, because that was how education that, and I, as an informal educator for a while, how I got to appreciate using real science in my
right.
day-to-day work, and broader impacts opened tons of doors. So is this taking a step back from that?
Yes.
Shit.
Yeah, that's a good word. I think the stepping up our engagement with the people who are making these short-sighted, uninformed decisions is going to be key. Because having the agencies walk away, not because we want to, but because we're basically being told by people who don't know what they're doing, is a real threat. It's another threat. You know, the grant program defunding is one, but if they, you know, say, you know, the Lynn Chambers and the, you know, the Nada Davises at NASA and so on, who are in the science enterprise, whose job it is to bring that science enterprise into the education enterprise, you know, in partnership, go away, you know, we're all diminished. So anyway, you know, sorry, it's not a good day.
No, it's very depressing. I'm sorry, but you know, I just partnered on a grant with Ben Kootman out of University of Miami Rasmus, and the CLIO project is his complete broader impacts. And here's this brilliant scientist, part of the IPCC, coming up with climate prediction models, and he said for the first time in his life he's excited about the broader impacts component of getting the work out that he's doing. And what you're telling me today is these little collaborations are going to be discouraged rather than further encouraged down the road. That's really a touch.
It may, the NSF broader impacts may hold. It might be where they do that is the non-grants part of the equation.
Oh, okay.
You know, the grant, the NSF still seems to hold a lot of sway, but even there it's starting to get weakened. But I think at NSF it would be more the amount of grants, not the the broader impacts. But I'm talking about the, you know, the science enterprise inside the federal government who work with education. That
so,
may be getting
so your work in particular, Frank, then, you as a liaison between science and society,
yes.
Where do you fit in this future scenario?
Well, if my boss goes away, not well. But right now I'm getting all solid, you know, green lights from my leadership to stay and persist and all that. But, you know, OMB and other places like that may make it more hard for us. They just don't think that, they don't understand what they're doing. So, you know, I mean, it just seems to be, you know, the ramifications of the hard economy that they keep on squeezing hard. You know, NOAA understands why it's in education from the science side. Above it is where it gets to be problematic.
That's why some of these private foundations need to step up and really contribute to the overall effort here.
Mark, that's really where I was starting on this is I think we have a strong niche, but you know, the majority of the resources is going to have to come from other venues that are appropriately developed. But I mean, the amount of money to do this lifting is well in excess of you know, the grant programs. It's just, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. So that, you know, somewhere down the line, we're going to have to broaden the conversation to those who have access to that, begin nurturing those relationships.
And you know what? Those foundations, you know, I'm duking it out now with the Kresge Foundation that likes to fund action science. And I want to broaden the conversation. And he's like, well, convince me. So they're almost, they're almost throwing it at us to frame our arguments for the need to fund some of this other level of engagement and bridging society.
Can you explain that again, Caroline? I didn't follow your statement.
The Kresge Foundation, KRESGE,
yeah.
The National Foundation, and I was introduced by one of my board members to one of the people there to try and get funding for what I'm doing in engagement, public engagement. So the guy pretty much kind of turned me away and said, no, we want to fund on-the-ground science. And, you know, they were part of the funders for the Southeast Florida Regional Compact, this four-county mega plan for resilience for this area. Well, they haven't done a damn thing except plan it. So they're just talking about it. There's no political will. So I have started taking on this fella, this very friendly back and forth between us, where he's trying to say to me, well, convince me that the Kresge Foundation should support this kind of thing and not just on-the-ground stuff. And so I threw back, well, you know what, because we got great plans going now, but no political will whatsoever to engage and get them done. And if you don't fund public engagement and education, you're never going to get that political will. Everybody wants to fund the planning, but we don't want to fund the voting on and the legislating and the... So he's coming around, but what you just triggered in saying let's go after foundations is My argument is different, but perhaps in the name of education, in the deepest and broadest sense, we need to frame our arguments as to why some of these foundations and Heinz foundations and Rockefeller foundations and these other ones that should be throwing big money out on what you're doing and bridging Noah and society and what others are doing, like Mark and so. So I just suggested maybe we want to think about framing some of that rationale.
Yeah.
So how would you recommend facilitating that conversation or preparing that conversation for that framing? I mean, are we talking a white paper? Are we talking a briefing? I mean, what's the way that to move that forward?
I was just taken aback where, you know, I write these 3-page proposals to try and keep it brief, and there is rationale in there for what I'm doing. And so I'm thinking if the funder reads the proposals, they're getting some of the rationale. But they were interested in a negotiation as why to even open that door. I was taken aback by that, well, defend yourself and explain why kind of approach
right.
to bantering. So I don't know. I really
well,
don't know.
You know, oftentimes they have very clear and sometimes very narrow strategic guidelines or priorities, and you know, if you can make the case of why they need to rethink this or go beyond the limited focus there, that you know, they may be open to it. But
well, that's what I'm suggesting, perhaps, Mark, that
yeah.
some of the that don't include that in their RFPs, in their guidelines, might be inclined to do so if we were to frame.
Yeah.
Some of it, you know.
This is Marta. I'm sorry, you guys, I joined late. Can you just tell me what the this is that you're talking about? I'm so sorry to have to ask.
Well, it's a small group today, Marta, and so we've just been kind of thrashing around a bit on talking about the next generation science standards, but also the need for funding, because the standards are all well and good, but how are teachers going to be trained? Where are the good resources? The federal funding is going away, and how do we, you know, find those private foundations that can really step up? I mean, I think part of what we're discussing right now is how do you make the case to them when, in some cases, like the Hewlett Foundation has put $140 million into open education resources over the past 10 years, but they're not funding anything related to climate education.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a lot of foundations in the Bay Area, but most of them, if they're dealing with climate, it's not climate education. If they're dealing with education, it's not climate related. So it's, once again, these crucial 21st century topics kind of are falling through the cracks here, or they're, you know, thrashed around as part of the culture wars.
Right.
Although, you know, Mark, perhaps David McConville's thread that he's been moving forward for the past couple of days is an interesting one to capture the wider frame.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, you know, it's not just climate change. You know, global poverty is a real issue. Women health issues is a real issue. Access to water is a real issue. I mean, there's lots of other biodiversity loss is a real issue. It's not any one thing. And so I'm wondering if there isn't a strategy conversation that is needed to how to position what we're talking about without walking away from climate change. But I would imagine you need a bigger pitch
if
you're going to really make a large, return on that pitch.
Yeah,
I mean, we're talking $140 million. It's not just going to work just on one thing.
Well, you know, the Union of Concerned Scientists had a great thing out today. They've just launched a Center for Science and Democracy or something. And pretty much that's an umbrella that resonates with me. The need or the importance, the urgency of science in a democracy and respect for science. To me, that's the biggest umbrella for all the things we're trying to work towards scientific literacy or environmental literacy or climate literacy or whatever. And so in terms of an umbrella, I'm agreeing with you, Frank. I'm just thinking I kind of like what they came up with. And I think pitching to funders the need for an engaged citizenship, an educated citizenship, an involved, a systems thinking citizenship,
right,
can be some of the framing we start thinking of doing, pitching.
Caroline, what I'd maybe the best way to do this, and we've done this a couple times in this community, is where we sit down and we really sharpen our focus, and we've written documents together, we've written papers together, we've done proposals together. I don't know what the right vehicle is, but I think if we kind of get our minds wrapped around something in a more common frame. And Marta, you always bring a wider field here, which is always very invigorating and important. It's not just scientific information that we're talking about.
Right.
The religious communities are very active in this space about, you know, what we should do as opposed to what science tells us will happen if we do these things. For wider reasons. Anyway, I know it's rambly, but I think as a community, this is going to be a community. If we got the money, we would do it together. So let's maybe capture our thinking together.
Yeah. So as I mentioned at the start of the top of the hour, I have to take off in about 10 minutes, and you obviously can keep on chatting. But before I sign off, I just wanted to make sure that Lisa and Roberta and Marta have a chance to just update the rest of us about anything that might be new in their world. Lisa, do you have anything to report? Or?
Hi, thank you. Yes, this is Lisa Kelly from Brookfield Zoo. I'm representing the Climate Literacy Zoo Education Network, CLIZN. It's a quick update. Our website, CLIZN.org, CLIZEN.org, will be updated this week to include links for free downloads to a couple of our products, one being an ebook, Climate Change Education, a Primer for Zoos and Aquariums, which has implications for cultural institutions beyond zoos, aquariums as well, and a download of our final report of a visitor survey of climate change attitudes and behaviors of zoo and aquarium visitors. But to connect back to the conversation we were just having, I'd certainly be interested in working with the group, and also I'd like to make sure that we keep in mind the social science research that's available to us as well, and I'd like to be a part of that.
Yeah, great. And so I think just one quick thing that ties in with our discussion here and David McConville's thread is the work that the folks at the Sustainability or Resiliency, Stockholm Resiliency Center have been working on for a number of years, where they talk about planetary boundaries. So that's obviously more than just climate, and there's obviously a lot of depressing things going on out there in terms of human impacts on the environment, and we always need to weave in solutions in order to really engage people and not be just gloom and doom. But I'll send out a couple of links to the list around this concept of planetary boundaries, just so everybody can take a look at those. So, Roberta, what's happening in Kentucky that you might like to share with us?
It's been a little while since I've been on one of these calls, but a few months back, Kentucky Department of Education did accept the Kentucky Environmental Literacy Plan that I and a lot of other environmental educators in Kentucky have been working on. So it's in the next phase of implementation, I guess, working out how to make this plan put it into action without spending any money, of course. It's going to be interesting. We haven't gotten into it specifics, like specific topics or that kind of thing. The main goal of this plan is to make sure that students graduating from high school are environmentally literate, which includes a lot of the kinds of things that, our list, our group, is interested in. So that's kind of been big news for us, but again, I just wonder about implementation, and now that I'm looking at the next generation science standards, I again wonder where this is going to lead us. I read several emails and articles, and I don't remember where I read them, but it seems like some folks are saying, nationally, are saying about these next generation standards that the sticking points are going to be evolution and climate change. And I just, that just makes me wonder where Kentucky is going to fall in that, mm-hmm. and whether there's going to be any kind of a fight. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, wouldn't that fight have already been had?
In the
1800s?
Yeah. No. I mean, specifically in this process, because wouldn't Kentucky knew what was in the framework, and Kentucky agreed, unless not all of Kentucky agreed together, and one part agreed, but the other part didn't know that that's what they're agreeing to until now they do.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The person who heads the Kentucky Environmental Education Council, I was talking to her the other day, and she said about that Kentucky representative that he often tends to go his own way. So I don't know if, you know, what that really means. You know, in Kentucky, coal is king, so who knows who's going to come out of the woodwork to fight what on this. We'll just have to see. So far, nothing has been said about it, really.
So maybe just on this point, what is when the standards are released in December or something like that, how does a state join? I mean, at what level does the state have to join the standards in order to stay in the set of 26, or the growing number, or the shrinking number, whatever it is? But I've never heard anybody describe that.
I don't really know.
I mean, what some of the news releases that I've been reading have said is that by being one of those states, that and also by virtue of the fact that I guess we're behind on having adopted new science standards, there's a lot of pressure to accept them, and that it would not look good if we rejected them. That's all I've really read. So I don't know. I don't know what the process happens, how that happens, because I'm a non-formal educator, so a little bit different.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of those questions can be answered next week, or maybe even sooner.
And let me just close by saying to Frank, I have no idea if this conversation today warrants significant follow-up. So putting it out there that maybe we want to do this is the first step towards deciding what would be a good next step. And I couldn't inform that right now. All right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Good. Marta, what's new with you?
So we're doing a bunch of behind-the-scenes work that I'm sort of praying for, which is basically trying to get the National Endowment for the Arts to be interested in joining the U.S. GCRP group, and also to be meeting with the National Science Foundation and basically hooking them up with different folks. And so now it's getting to a higher level, and I'm hoping to talk with the deputy director of the NEA this week to have that happen. So there's been a lot of sort of working with program officers there whom I've worked with in the past, but it looks like there's movement, so we'll see what happens. I'm kind of excited about it.
Sure.
And then we're working with Tipping Point in London to put together a meeting of partisan scientists and resubmitting our NSF grant, and that's going very slowly, but Robert Redford said he would come, schedule permitting, so that's exciting.
All
and
right.
Then lastly, we have a small project here that we're just embarking on, which is working with a Native American filmmaker to work with middle school kids and to create short films that have to do with climate change and food resources and Native traditions. So that should be fun.
Excellent.
Great.
All right, so I need to take off in just a minute, but...
This is Martha Shaw. I'm getting ready for you.
Hey, Martha.
I'm going to Rio. Is anybody else going to Rio?
Dog. That's great.
No, we're not going to Rio.
I'll be there.
So can you tell us a little bit about your plans there?
I've been working on Plastic-Free Rio. Trying to have some alternatives to plastic down there, kind of a walk the talk initiative that I have a Facebook page. And I'm working with oceans, mainly on Global Oceans Day. And otherwise, just kind of seeing what's happening. I've been going to all of the prep meetings, and it's not good. I don't have anything really good to report from that.
Sorry, just that there might be, if you go down there, I'd love to connect with you before you go down, just because Culture Futures might have a great big, huge convening there that might be of interest. And Chris Jordan, who's a really brilliant photographer, has done lots of photography about the plastic and the different oceans.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Really, really great. Frightening.
Tomorrow, why? Do you think he'll be down there?
He might be.
His name?
His name is Chris Jordan. If you just Google chrisjordan.com, you'll come up with his photos.
Well,
but if you email, what's your email? And I'll shoot you an email real quick after the call, and we can connect.
I'm Martha at earthadvertising.com.
Okay, cool.
Well, we can talk about it next week.
Oh, good idea. Okay.
All right. Well, I have to sign off, and you're all welcome to stay and chat if you're interested, but... if you can join us next week to discuss the next generation science standards, it'll be a two-hour discussion, and the first part will really focus on kind of an overview of the process and the content of the standards, and then we'll be going through, as we did with the NRC framework about a year and a half ago, to make sure that we're all in agreement that we come up with critique that we can pass on through the appropriate channels. All right?
Mark, is the 1 o'clock, is it 1 to 3, or is it noon to...
Yeah, I think it's 1 to 3, but I haven't... Let's see here if I...
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in that webinar.
Yeah, I think there's an NSTA webinar that Ted Willard sent a note out to on the list yesterday.
Oh, okay.
And so that's tonight at 6 o'clock Eastern.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Yeah, I think from looking at Tamara's email about the discussion next week, they're extending it to 2 hours, so it'll be starting at the same time, but just going an hour longer.
Awesome.
All right. I need to scoot.
Cool.
All right.
Okay. Good luck.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thank
bye-bye.
You.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Yeah, anybody has anything about Rio, please let me know.
Okay.
Great. Thanks, all.